If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
So we obviously are going to be focusing on what has been happening over the weekend in the Middle East. As you know, that while the Iran and Israel had been going at it for a couple of days, the U.S. decided to intervene and throwing three bombs at what they call nuclear sites in Iran. And so we have on the line with us Dr. Kelvin Kim, who's a nuclear physicist and a chairperson of Stratech. Thank you very much, Dr. Kim, for making time for us. Good evening and welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Kim, let's just start by, you know, the very beginning in maybe you clarifying for us that we've been hearing, obviously, concerns from, you know, parties like the Israel, that the, and of course the U.S., that Iran is sitting with nuclear bombs, or at least that they're very close to putting together a nuclear bomb. And it's been for a few years now, but they keep saying that they're very close to producing a nuclear bomb. How close was Iran from producing a nuclear bomb?
Well, nobody actually knows. You know, it's the intelligence services that will know that from my position watching, I can't tell. But some of the people said very close. I don't think it was that close personally. It's my estimate. But what happens when you make a nuclear weapon, there's two aspects. One is the actual bomb itself, or the mechanism, and the other is the uranium. If we can make an analogy, it's like saying you want to make a motor car engine. Mm. You say, okay, it's a case of making the motor car engine, and then you've got to make the petrol.
Yeah.
And that's a different matter. So making the engine is one thing, but you've got to make the petrol as well.
Yes.
So in the case of the nuclear weapon, you've got to make the whole weapon system, and then you've got to make the enriched uranium that goes in it. And the difficult one out of the two is the enriched uranium. And that can be done very quietly and unobtrusively, so that's why you won't know how far they've got. Mm-hmm. Because when uranium comes out of the ground, it comes out as a mixture of two different isotopes. One is called uranium-238, the other one's called uranium-235. The 238 is just over 99%, and the uranium-235 is just a bit less than 1% of the mixture. But the important one is the one that's nearly 1%,
yes.
The 235. That's the one that can explode. Mm-hmm. So you've now got, if you take normal uranium out of the ground, natural uranium, mm-hmm. it won't work mm-hmm. for a nuclear weapon. It won't work for anything, in fact.
Yes.
So what they have to do for a nuclear weapon is they've got to enrich it, which means you've got to increase the percentage of the uranium-235 way above that 1%.
Mm-hmm.
Now let me just digress for a moment. If you look at a reactor like Kuburg,
yeah.
Kuburg works on an enrichment of about, say, under 5%. I'm jumping in round units here.
Yes.
5% is the Kuburg ballpark.
Yes.
The next level up is like a 10% level, mm-hmm. which is the level that the small modular reactor that we developed in Pretoria, the HTMR-100, runs at the 10% mark.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a while back, the international community got together and worried about people getting into uranium enrichment, so they set a level of 20%. And they said, right, below 20% will be considered commercial territory,
mm-hmm.
and over 20%, there's no need for you to go unless you're starting to get into military things.
Yeah.
And that was accepted by the world.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's also various agreements that people agree to abide by these rules. And a few years ago, I spoke to the previous Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mr. Amano. And Mr. Amano said to me that South Africa is so well behaved. He said if everybody was as well behaved as South Africa is, he wouldn't have any worries in his job because mm-hmm. we abide by everything exactly according to the agreements.
Mm-hmm.
But others don't. And over the years now, Iran has been one of those that hasn't been playing ball with the International Atomic Energy Agency with anybody else. They've been like hiding their facilities and so on. So nobody's quite sure what they're doing. And so that's what's making the neighbors and other people in the world nervous. Now, another thing, when you make this enriched uranium, there's an amount called the critical mass. When you get above that amount, it'll explode.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can make it explode.
Mm-hmm.
And that amount is only about twice or possibly three times the size of a cricket ball.
Yep.
So you can effectively carry it in a suitcase. It's heavier than gold, so it's heavy,
mm-hmm.
but it's not a big amount. So that amount could be made in some pretty small place hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the problem, that they know that Iran has enriched up to 60%. Now, for a bomb, you need to get like to 90%.
Okay.
And the concern was, have they gone beyond that 60% and are they pushing towards the real bomb-grade stuff without anybody knowing? Now, clearly, you'd be very concerned that your next-door neighbor was making hand grenades as a hobby
mm-hmm.
and throwing them around in the garden, maybe. You'd be pretty nervous. You say, look, let's stop this before we get to the point where there's an accident or something goes horribly wrong. And that's what the state of play was, that nobody knew what was going on. And they didn't allow the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors to come in and do full inspections.
Hmm.
They allowed them to come in and do certain things. It's like, say, you can search my house for the stolen money anywhere you like, except you can't go into that room. Then what's the point? And that's just what was happening. So this is the whole tangle of what's been going on. So now the U.S. in collaboration with Israel and whoever else might have been involved took the preemptive step to make jolly sure that they can't make the enriched uranium from the 60% to the 90% quickly and take people by surprise. So that's where we stand at the moment.
So the bombs that were thrown into these sites by the U.S., I mean, how dangerous is the uranium that they obviously, they say they destroyed? How safe is the environment for themselves, even for the region in Iran? I mean, the IAEA says today that they are very concerned about the environmental impact. Are you concerned?
No, not really. The uranium in that state is very, very mildly radioactive. In fact, it's safe enough you can carry it around in your hand if you want to. The rules of you dealing with it don't allow you to do things like that, but you could. It's perfectly safe. You can sit next to a fuel element of Kuburg nuclear power station and have your lunch without any trouble whatsoever. However, when that fuel element comes out of the nuclear reactor, that's a different ballgame. If a Kuburg fuel element was dropped into the hall of morning assembly at a school, it would probably kill everybody in the room. So there's a huge difference between uranium before it goes into a nuclear reactor and when it comes out.
Hmm.
So the material that was blown up effectively was the material before. So even if it gets thrown around a bit, there's no radiation danger to worry about.
Okay.
It'll be absolutely minimal. And as the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mr. Grossi, has now said, they've There's no evidence of having found any. Somebody's gone and had a bit of a look and reported to him, and he says, no, it's okay, there isn't any. One wouldn't particularly expect it either, because when the U.S. launched their attack, they used two types of weapons. One was these big bunker buster bombs. And what happens is those are very heavy things weighing about 13 tons and about 3 meters in length. And when they drop those from an aeroplane, they'll reach a speed of something like 300 kilometers an hour. When they hit the ground, they bury themselves in the ground pretty deeply. And then that whacking big load of explosive, it detonates. And what you effectively get is like a little earthquake. So it shakes everything up. So it's not as if it blows great big holes in the air or anything like that and throws muck all over the place. I haven't seen the outcome other than what I've seen on TV and so on. But the idea was to shake everything around rather than blow it up as such. So quite likely the tunnels underground and various things caved in and they heavily disrupted what was going on.
Mm.
The other ones that they used, they fired quite a lot of cruise missiles from submarines and possibly aircraft as well. Those are very, very accurate. And the cruise missile flies watching the ground as it travels and it knows exactly where it is. You can program it to go through the front door of a house, and it can do that type of thing with great accuracy. Those were sent to aim for the tunnels and various other buildings and so on the surface, which they would have hit with not so much explosive, but with high precision. So they very high precision took things out or sent these missiles maybe even flying into the front entrance of a tunnel and so on. So that was all the damage that was done. The damage was to intended to stop them functioning rather than blowing them up as such.
Okay.
And so that's where we stand now. You know, it's very interesting to see all this unfolding. Mm. Now, if I may, I'd like to just mention something else that people don't understand is there is an international agreement called the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which means you undertake not to make nuclear weapons and not to do things going in that direction. Now, some years ago, South Africa developed nuclear weapons from scratch, and we made them. And at the ground, just before the 1994 elections and so on, the F.W. de Klerk at the time made the announcement to the world that we've got them, but we decided that it was not the way to go, and we would now destroy our nuclear weapons, and we'd stop uranium enrichment, we'd stop the thing, and we'd do it in public under International Atomic Energy Agency supervision, and it was all on world TV, and that was what was done. At that stage, we signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We had not done that before. So at that point, we said, okay, we won't make weapons ever again, and we won't do things that put us in a position to do that. And that's the state of play now. Now, when that, it's called the NPT Treaty for short. When that NPT came about, there were five countries in the world that already had nuclear weapons. That was the United States, Russia, England, France, and China. So they said they're not prepared to give up their weapons because at that stage there was tensions between them. So they said, okay, the five that have got them can keep them, but nobody else can get any. And now that was a bit unfair, but it was the only way at that stage to get this thing functional. So it's still the case that those five countries are still allowed to have weapons, although they have limitations that they've agreed to, that they won't make more than a certain number. And everybody else is supposed to not do this, but you're supposed to sign the NPT. Now, a country like Israel has not signed the NPT, nor has North Korea, and nor have a few other countries. So they then are not bound by the provisions. They said, we're not going to sign it. So South Africa is a signatory, so we abide by this. But the others don't necessarily do so. That brings in some measure of dual standards, but that's the reality of life at the moment.
Is Iran a signatory? I believe it was.
Exactly how far they've signed, I don't know, to be honest, but there's different levels that you can sign up. Like in South Africa with the International Atomic Energy Agency, we have signed the highest level agreement that they've got. And what that does is it allows any IAEA inspector to come to South Africa at any time and ask to immediately be taken to any nuclear facility. And we will immediately take them and let them see whatever they want. So we've got an absolute open door policy here that they can come and look at whatever they like. Now, Iran had signed certain things, but as I said earlier, they were saying you can come in and look around, but you can't look there, and you can't look there, and you can't do that. So it rather defeats the purpose. So you either go all the way or you don't.
Yeah.
And if somebody signs the NPT and then doesn't abide by it, it's very difficult to do anything about it. When you sign something like that, I make the analogy, it's something like joining the golf club. When you join the golf club, there are rules about dress when you come into the dining room in the evening. There's dress on the golf course. So there's all sorts of good manners rules and things like that in the golf club. But the golf club can't arrest you and put you in jail if you don't. At worst, they can throw you out of the golf club or they can censure you some way or other. So when you join the golf club, your intention is to abide by the rules and to be a good member. And that's how the International Atomic Energy Agency works. So they want people to be collaborative. And we South Africans go out of our way to collaborate with everybody concerned. If you don't want to collaborate, there's all sorts of ways you can hide things. And so it's really up to a country to very openly show that it's collaborating and wants to be cooperative. And that hadn't happened.
What measures
so they might have been. Carry on.
What measures are in place if a signatory does not comply?
Well, it's a difficult one because if you don't comply, they can like with the golf club analogy again, if you don't comply, they tell everybody that you're not behaving yourself. Then other people that you might trade with in nuclear matters then stop dealing with you. Like South Africa is one of the premier exporters of nuclear medicine around the world. We export nuclear medicine every day to over 60 countries. So that brings in a lot of money to South Africa, foreign exchange. Now, if we broke some rules, they might say to a number of the countries, the South Africans are not towing the line. So then the people say, well, they'll stop buying the nuclear medicine from us. So it hurts financially. They can't come here and effectively put us in jail. It's a case of just making life unpleasant.
Okay.
And at worst, they could, you know, if they throw you out of the agreement, it hardly serves its purpose because then you're outside and you can do whatever you like.
Okay.
So the idea is to just keep cracking the whip and making life difficult for you until you decide to toe the line.
And so
that's, you know.
If obviously I understood you correctly, Israel is not a signatory, but how much do we know about what enriched uranium Israel has?
But officially, we don't know. We don't know whether Israel has got a nuclear weapon or not, and we don't know what enrichment they've been doing, but it's been sort of common knowledge for many years that they have got one, or in fact, more than one. And that they were able to do this. So everybody assumes that they are perfectly nuclear capable of using one if they need to. Now, obviously, being such a small country, if they ever felt that they were going to be invaded, I reckon they would use it because there's nothing else left for them. So it's a very dangerous situation to squeeze them too much because as a last resort, they would use such a weapon, I imagine. And so that is why this whole thing about that Middle East area is a potential proverbial domino, sort of one does something, the others can go fast. And then the nuclear weapons are not that big. You know, you can easily carry it in an aeroplane. In fact, you can even make small ones that are can go in a motor car or something like that. So the potential for getting one into the U.S., for argument's sake, it's feasible. And so it's not just a case of big military aeroplanes coming over your country that could be spotted. They could be brought in very much more surreptitiously than that. And therefore, the people like the U.S. would be very concerned that there might be a mechanism to bring one into the U.S. and detonate it.
While they themselves have.
So it's understandable why they're worried.
While they themselves actually have one.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, a lot more than one, but yes.
I really, really appreciate you taking us through all of this, Dr. Calvin Kim, who's a nuclear physicist and a chairperson of Stratech. Actually listening into that conversation is Professor Jeff Halper. We've spoken to him before. I believe he is currently in Jerusalem, director of Israeli Committee Against House Demolition. Professor Halper, thank you so much for your time. And again, welcome to Point of View.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here, and I am in Jerusalem.
You're in Jerusalem. Are you safe? Do you feel safe?
Well, safe is a relative term when they're throwing ballistic missiles at you. But, I mean, fortunately, Jerusalem isn't being targeted. Mm-hmm. The targeting is more the missiles are falling or being aimed at more the Tel Aviv area, the center of the country, up to Haifa, and in the north. I think the Iranian Shiites don't want to be the Muslim population that destroys the Al-Aqsa Mosque by a stray missile. And so I think we're pretty safe. I call that my Al-Aqsa insurance policy.
Okay. I mean, I know it's not meant to be funny, but I think, you know, it's any funny moment is welcome. What's the
moment? No, I mean, like? I mean, it's true. It's true. I mean,
that's a good point. Yeah, it's a good point that I hadn't thought of that. But it's a really
I live about a kilometer and a half from the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And the missiles, I mean, you know this much better than I do. The ballistic missiles, the long-range ones, are not precise missiles. And they have a kilometer or two or sometimes even more radius of error. And so, you know, even if you're aiming at West Jerusalem, the Jewish part of the city, I mean, there's a good chance, such a small city, that you could hit both a Muslim holy site in Jerusalem, but also, of course, the Palestinian population that is in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. So from that point of view, I mean, it's funny and cute, but also true, that the Iranians are aiming their missiles much more to the west and the north.
What's the mood like currently, Professor Harper, in Israel?
Well, I mean, the mood certainly since yesterday is pretty jubilant. I mean, Israelis have all supported the attack on Iran. I mean, they all buy the story, and you've been talking about this and how it isn't true, that, you know, Iran was on the cusp of developing a nuclear weapon. And, you know, as Netanyahu says, this was an existential move on the part of Israel, and we only had a number of hours even, or days or weeks before we could end their nuclear program. And then, of course, there was concern about their ballistic missiles as well, that program as well. And that makes sense to the Israelis. You know, I mean there's a funny thing here. We live in a bubble. And Israeli Jews are not a part of the Middle East. They're much more a part of Europe. Mm. You know, we're in the Eurovision. We're in the European Basketball League. You know, we speak English as a foreign, as a second language. And everybody is sort of, we're sort of the southern branch of Europe. Mm. And from that point of view, there's a real disconnect from the entire region. Mm. People here don't know who the prime ministers are, what the internal politics are, anything about the region in general, including Iran, and they're not interested. And so, in a sense, they simply take at face value what the government says, and they have confidence in the army and then in the Air Force and, of course, the Navy and everything in terms of the efficiency of the attack that was borne out, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. And we live under three domes of protection. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lower-level iron dome. Mm. There's a middle-level David Sling, as it's called, and there's an upper-level Arrow 2, mm-hmm. now an Arrow 3 system. So Israelis, even though there are a few missiles that have gotten through, Israelis feel fairly confident and secure and disconnected from the political discussion around.
Since all of this, what does this politically mean for Netanyahu, internally, domestically?
Well, it's great for him. There's now a new narrative beginning to emerge, in which October 7th allowed, or in a sense, even there's even some religious members of the parliament who are saying it was a blessing, it was a miracle, October 7th, hmm. And Netanyahu is putting this in more political terms. In that it opened up this whole realm of opportunity for Israel to basically clear the table, mm. you know, to destroy Hezbollah, now to destroy or degrade Iran's military capabilities, to hit the Houthis, of course, to destroy Hamas and the Palestinian resistance, mm. and in a sense to create a regional reality in which Israel is the military hegemon. And the Arab governments have no choice except to deal with Israel, and basically, I think Netanyahu would say this is kind of the end of the conflict. We are now going to go on to normalization with the Arab world, and that's Trump's Abraham Accords, of course. We've neutralized our enemies, and we've succeeded in colonizing Palestine. The Palestinians have been defeated, and they'll be marginalized in a Bantustan, you know, which is a term you're more than familiar with.
Yeah.
And so, so in a sense, October 7th in the new narrative was a good thing, and it was an opening. So what Netanyahu is trying to do is get out from under the responsibility for the failure of October 7th that was hanging over his head, that was a political threat to him, and, of course, the hostages have never been released yet that are still there, and that's hanging over him, and simply marginalizing it, making that the kind of the minimal, the opening shot for this wonderful achievement he has achieved by basically destroying Israel's enemies and paving the way towards normalization with the Arab world.
Is there still any talk about the hostages?
No. The hostages have almost completely been overshadowed. I mean, there are, you know, mentions of it. But, you know, it's interesting. I'll just give you one tiny example. The news for the last, you know, year and a half has always opened, the news broadcasts on TV, all the channels have always opened with, today is the 175th day of the Gaza war. Today is the 570th day. Today is the 620th day. You know, day by day, and especially with all the pictures of the hostages behind, and every day mentioning at least one hostage, you know, that's still being held, that's no more. Since last week, now the news opens, this is day seven of the war in Iran. This is day nine of the war in Iran. In other words, the war in Iran has absolutely eclipsed what's happening in Gaza. You know, in Gaza, there are something like 50 Palestinians a day who are being killed trying to access food in these terrible, you know, food distribution centers that are really kill zones for the Israeli army. Israelis never heard that. It's never mentioned in the news. Gaza has been completely blacked out, including the hostage issue.
Does Israel believe that Trump will forever be the supporter? I mean, I believe now he is trying to negotiate for China to intervene, because obviously this will have implications for the globe if we cannot get fuel through. So are there any concerns that Trump may sort of, you know, track back a little bit?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, Netanyahu calls himself and Trump a team. He sees them as a team. No, I don't think so. I don't think Trump is particularly committed to Israel in any way. You know, he's completely transactional. He would throw Israel off a cliff if it served his purposes. But in fact, I think there's very much a coming together of interests between the United States and Israel. And don't forget, there's another thing here that's kind of interesting. You know, I wrote a book called War Against the People that deals with this. Israel's become not only the military hegemon of the Middle East, you know, through its development of weapons in what I call the Palestinian laboratory, but Israel really has become you know, one of the main enforcers, both of global capitalism, but also, you know, of helping regimes keep, repressive regimes keep control over their populations. And so Israel has very close relations with China. It's, you know, it's like the third or fourth largest arms supplier to China, not to mention surveillance and all of that. It's very, very close to India. I mean, you know, Modi's Hindu nationalist movement grew up together with Zionism, very much in contact. It's very close to Russia. Israel has never sold arms or given arms to the Ukraine, for example. And so Israel is really kind of a bridge. You know, it's not a choice. Can we move ahead in the Middle East that Trump would have to make if we bring China in? Now, what do we do about Israel? No, Israel's right there with everyone. If anything, Israel could bridge negotiations between the United States and China over what's happening in this region. So Israel really, you know, plays a key role, and that's one of the bases of its strength here in the region.
So of course, what seems to me to be the case is that it's not only about the preemptive strikes, not only about the nuclear bomb, they are also about regime change. It's been made quite clear. You know, from where you stand, do you think that's likely to happen?
It's hard to know. I mean, the real question is, in a way, would regime change be what everybody sort of expects? Okay, we overthrow the Ayatollahs, and now the Iranian people rise up, and now we have a liberal, progressive, you know, democratic regime. I mean, it could go the other way. Mm. I could see a much more likely scenario where the Ayatollahs are either overthrown or marginalized, sidelined, and the Islam and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard takes over. I mean, they're the powerful element in the country today. Mm. They're the armed, organized, very ideologically committed group, the only group really in Iran. So if there is regime change, I think it would be towards a more repressive regime run by the Revolutionary Guards rather than by some vague democratic movement that really doesn't exist today.
The Arab states, though, themselves are not quite real allies to Iran. So that kind of, you know, makes the waters a bit murky. In the end, I don't know how much you can foresee what's going to happen with Iran, but do you feel like Iran is actually in a corner or not likely, not really?
No, I think it is in a corner. I mean, what we have to understand is that, beyond the, the Israeli issue that kind of overshadows other things in the Middle East, you know, there is a contest between the Sunni world, led today really by Saudi Arabia, and the Shiite, world led by Iran, that had its proxies in Lebanon and Yemen and Iraq and Syria and so on. So that in a sense, what's emerging now is a co-hegemonic relationship, rule over the Middle East between Israel, that's the military hegemon, in alliance with Saudi Arabia, that is the economic hegemon. Mm. And what Israel has really done is eliminate the third rival for hegemony in the region, which is Iran, both militarily, but also in terms of the Shia challenge to Sunni domination in the area. So in many ways, Israel has really, has really done the dirty work, to quote Chancellor Merz in Germany. Israel's really done the dirty work for Saudi Arabia and the Sunni regimes by eliminating this Iranian challenge to them. So that even makes Israel's position stronger here in the Middle East, all, of course, at the expense of the Palestinians.
And in a way, from what you've just said, that discussion is no longer even a thing anymore. So the Palestinians, Israel continues to bomb. I don't even know what's there still left to bomb in Palestine.
Well, that's right. And there isn't. I mean, this is simply a campaign of mass murder now. Genocide, mass murder. The army has said for a year now, there are no more military targets. There's nothing left that we can only attack and bomb and destroy civilian targets. Like we said, the dozens of Palestinians are being killed every day simply to access food. So there's a regime of engineered starvation in Gaza. And it's all, because... going back to what we talked about before, the big shadow, over Netanyahu is the hostages. If he can get the hostages back, the 20 or so that are still alive and 30 or so bodies, if he can get them back, then in a sense, he would be largely forgiven for the failure of October 7th, given what's happened in Iran. So in a sense, they're trying to keep the pressure on Hamas and making things so terrible that Hamas will simply have to surrender and give up the hostages. So far, it hasn't worked. But in the meantime, hundreds and hundreds of Palestinians have been killed. And the world is really, it's true, has turned its back. Who thinks of the Palestinians in Gaza anymore? Not to mention the Palestinians of the West Bank, that are also being, Israel talks about the Gazification of the West Bank. So the Israeli army is very strongly, attacking with conventional military weapons the refugee camps in the north, and has released the violent settlers to drive Palestinians off their lands in the rest of the West Bank. Mm. So all this ethnic cleansing and genocide is going on in preparation for, as a pressure to release hostages in the immediate, but really in preparation for this getting back to the normalization project, completing the Abraham Accords if Saudi Arabia comes back in, and then Israel's free. Israel has Judaized Palestine. It's taken over the whole country. Palestinians are locked into a little Bantustan. And Israel has normal diplomatic relations with the Sunni Arab world and the international community. And basically, Zionism has won. So it's really looking, even in the next few months, for a victory of Zionist settler colonialism over the Palestinians.
So it's one thing for the Israeli citizens to feel relatively safe within Israel. But we also know that some of these organizations have decided to fight outside of the actual territories. Do you believe and do Israeli citizens feel generally the world will be safer for them wherever they are?
No, I don't think so. And certainly that's the experience of Israelis going abroad today. They're meeting tremendous hostility, even in the streets. You know, the Israeli government tells Israelis, do not speak Hebrew when you're outside of the country. So, you know, you have that. But, you know, it's kind of built into the Israeli psyche, the idea that this is going to happen. It really, I think, is a result of Zionist settler colonialism. In other words, Israelis will be accepted in the world if Palestinians get their rights and if there can be a just resolution, you know, of the colonization of Palestine with the Palestinians. But Israelis don't see it that way. Israelis see this as simply anti-Semitism. And so, you know, they've been conditioned to believe that the world is anti-Semitic. It's always been anti-Semitic. It has nothing to do with the political, what Israel's doing in Gaza or to the Palestinians or in the wider Middle East or whatever. It only has to do with anti-Semitism. And so Israelis, in a sense, hunker down and live with it because they think it's simply an inescapable part of reality. They don't connect it to in other words, the whole idea that you could become a normal people living in the world normally and welcomed into the Eurovision and so on. If you would deal with the issue of Palestinian rights, that simply does not connect with them. And so they're willing to live with whatever hostility they encounter.
I really appreciate your take and stay safe. Thank you so much for talking to us as usual. The Director of Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, Professor Jeff Halper there, coming to us live from Jerusalem. And obviously we've been keeping an eye on what's happening. As I said to you, US space in Qatar has been struck by Iran earlier on. And so it's a moving target. This entire story keeps moving. And of course, if there are any major developments, we'll come back to them tomorrow.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.